From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, Park City Municipal Corporation has solar panels on the ice arena and several other buildings around town. Now they're contemplating installing it on the Mark. Joining us in the first part of the show is Matt Abbott. He's Environmental Project Manager with the Sustainability Department there. And Matt will discuss the possible plans of installing a large array of solar panels on the Mark roof. What will it cost? What will it save? Why do they want to do it?
All the hard-hitting questions.
And maybe even two other questions. I don't know.
Perfect. So you will hear all of that in the first half. And then in the second half, we'll be covering several environmental news highlights from the past week. A couple of these are about one of our favorite topics, the honeybee.
Yes.
And pollination. So we'll tell you about a reportedly honeybee-safe biopesticide, and then we'll also talk about the importance of bee diversity on fruit production and what a new study shows there. And then EJ Elliott, our show's intern, will be helping us out with the news items and talking about where the U.S. is warming the fastest.
Exactly. And then I'll share some of the top 10 to 50 things I learned attending the Governor's Energy Development Summit last week. Here's just two of them. Solar power makes up less than 1% of this state's energy production, but so do the number of jobs in the oil and gas industry. I'll explain.
Perfect. You are listening to This Green Earth, our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what our show is all about, and it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
This is Larry Warren, and next on Mountain Money, the Roadside MBA. We'll talk with the U of U professor who's learned back road lessons for those who run businesses large and small.
And this is Doug Wells. What's it like to do business with Warren Buffett? We'll talk with Steve Roney, whose brokerage has moved from the Prudential brand to that of the legendary Berkshire Hathaway brand.
Always something to take to the bank on Mountain Money, Monday at 9 after NPR News.
Brought to you by Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber Bureau, Iron Mountain Group, and Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Spring cleaning, moving, remodeling, donate your gently used construction materials and household items to the ReStore, your local home improvement reuse store today. Visit habitat-utah.org to see our list of accepted items or call 435-487-9015 to learn how to donate to the ReStore. Your donation helps keep thousands of tons of materials out of the waste stream and generates revenues for Habitat's affordable housing programs. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a local nonprofit organization.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, co-host Nell Larson across the board, and joining us in the studio this morning is Matt Abbott. He's Environmental Project Manager with Park City Municipal Corporation Sustainability Department, and he's here to talk amongst other things about a proposal to put a large, let's call it a large solar array on the roof of the Mark, Racquet Club. Thank you very much. It's the thing that
Chris,
I go to.
You're the Mark's biggest
at least
fan.
Twice a day. Yeah, I just go there. So Matt, thanks for joining us and helping to talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, good morning.
Give us some of the basics on the size and the potential energy generation of it.
Yeah, so we're scoped out for about 200 kilowatts. So that's around 800 panels. It's definitely our biggest system. It'll triple our total solar if we get the whole system installed, and that's the goal. Council approved the capital budget 2 weeks ago, and we're really excited to get the RFP out and to see what kind of system we can get up there.
So what was the I don't know, what was the impetus to get this project started? Has this been in the works for a while, or is this a new idea presented?
The building was designed for solar, so it's wired for it, and it's engineered for it, so we don't have to do any reinforcements on the main roof, which is a big advantage. We've had to do that with a few of our other structures with the snow loads up here. So it's a great project. We're primed for it, and we should be able to get a really good price too because of this. It's a simple roof to work with overall.
Right. And well oriented.
Yes.
Faces directly south.
Yeah.
So, okay. You say this is by far the largest system. What are some of the other systems you have up already?
So we have
six the largest one in
systems.
Operation.
Okay. Yeah. Six systems in total. I'm going to forget all the exact numbers, but, so City Hall has a system. The police station has a system. Public Works has a system. City Park has a system. The Ice Arena has a system. And that's five.
Yeah. Right. But those are, like you say, are quite small relative to this system. 2 kilowatts.
200,
I'm sorry, 200 kilowatts.
Yeah.
And 800 panels.
Yeah.
Okay.
So will this be creating electricity for just the Mark, or will this go beyond?
So the Mark is our number one electricity user and our number one natural gas user
of
all our facilities. So that many panels is about 18% of his total electricity use.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
18, yeah, because I read that it would save approximately $18,700 a year.
That's the average,
Yeah. And – but – so what's the capital cost for this thing?
So there's
– estimate right now.
I'm going to be elusive on that answer because the RFP – I know what I'm budgeted for.
Okay. What are you budgeted for?
The way I'm pursuing the RFP, I'm hoping for Rocky Mountain Power rebates.
Yes.
And there are other ways to finance a system this large. And there's some creativity that can be involved by the solar installer. So I'd like to keep them thinking about that.
Got it. Perfect. Got it. And that was one of my questions. Yeah. There is some opportunities, maybe some grants or some other type of assistance, state
Absolutely.
Or federal assistance to help pay for the capital costs.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely want scrappy proposals from local installers, American-made products. We want a great system at a great price, and that's the tough part.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you said the Mark is the largest user of electricity and natural gas. I mean, any sense of what dollar-wise what's spent to light and heat that place?
Yeah, I have pretty exact numbers on that.
Okay.
We're at about $112,000 in electricity usage. Our natural gas bill went down because we're on a bulk provider, but the total usage went up. So from like a management environmental perspective, we're kind of at a threat state there, not in a bad way, but if prices change or continue to go up. So I project electricity out at 5.5% increase per year. So if we've got fixed taxes here, right now, and no desire to really raise them. So if you have a building whose costs go up 4.5-5% a year, it gets expensive.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially over, like, we're looking at a 25-year system. And so you project 5.5% over 25 years, and it adds up fast.
Exactly.
So what's the – I mean, what are the biggest users of electricity? Like, why is this such an energy-intensive building?
So we still have some puzzles we're solving with the HVAC system. We have a really advanced HVAC system there, and it seems to be out of balance. So the example Johnson Controls gave, and we don't know if this is the case, is sometimes you'll have systems where hot and cold are fighting against each other. Like you got a system that wants to stay at like 65, let's say, and you have a boiler working against a chiller. And we haven't found anything like that. So it says something for our crews that we haven't been able to figure it out and the pros haven't been able to figure it out. But it makes an expensive system. And then you throw some pools in there. You air condition some tennis courts for you, Chris. And all of a sudden.
Man, Chris's carbon footprint is just massive.
I don't want air conditioning. I want to sweat. But I know
sweat it out
people,
on the court.
Yeah. But here you go, Matt. Here's an opportunity.
Uh-huh.
All right. On the second floor is where all the workout equipment is. Okay. And just in there, I walked around yesterday and I counted. I'm not kidding you. 206 separate sources of light. It just in that area, and these are lights that are they're on all day. You know, sunny day like today or yesterday, And, you know, there's a large part of that second floor that is has windows, and so it's naturally lit. I just think that there's opportunities there to look at the number of lights that are required and still remain within code. You mm-hmm. know, you have to have lighting, you have lighting codes yeah. or lumen requirements or so. I just think that there's opportunity. That's just in the second floor. It doesn't count the lighting of the track or the tennis courts or the first floor lobby area, which also has a lot. There's just a lot of sources of light there that, you know, looking at efficiency opportunities. Yeah. So
that's great feedback.
There's my patron feedback.
Well, I think this is an interesting conversation, though, like talking about the HVAC and the lighting. And a lot of times when buildings first open is when they use their most – or use energy most intensively. And mm-hmm. like speaking from experience at the Eco Center, we've been able to decrease our use of gas and energy over time because we've figured out the heating and the cooling, you know, HVAC systems and dialed that in. We've figured out – you know, we've split our lights out and split our circuits so that we can only use the lights we want. But that takes a while and yes. it takes some time and it's a lot harder than it sounds.
Yeah. And they're complicated systems too that like as smart as the controls are, they're only as smart as their programming.
Right.
And getting those dialed in takes a fair amount of time.
Right. So and the building is still young
yeah.
in it, so it's evolving in that sense.
Absolutely.
So anyway, if you said you were spending roughly $112,000 a year in electricity costs,
yeah.
And we said you'd save roughly $18,000 to $19,000 a year in mm-hmm. the with these solar panels. So
yeah.
that's 15% savings.
Yeah, yeah.
Year over year.
Depending on how we structure the upfront costs, it can really change our projections and the payback period and all that.
Okay. So how long would it take to install a system like that?
You know, I am not exactly sure. I've heard 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah. So it can be done in a couple months.
Yeah. And our initial assessments, we're looking at like 1,100 footings on that main roof there, which is it's a lot of footings for a lot of panels.
Yeah. But again, that's a roof that is just primed for solar. Like you say, it was built with that in mind, constructed with that in mind.
So how long do you expect a system like this to last? What's the durability of these panels?
The panels are warrantied for 25 years. And they're like factory degradation is about 0.5% a year for productivity. So it should be no problem with a 25-year system.
Perfect. Okay.
Well, I think it's a great idea. It's all up to the economics.
Yeah.
And how making that work and the return on investment. Do you have a sense of what the ROI is on this?
The simple line payback's about 24 years.
Yeah.
When we loop it into the rest of our portfolio, and we have a pretty big portfolio and a lot of things coming online, our total portfolio should be paid off by 2030. So that's substantially shorter when we loop in something like micro hydro. But those are all out there projects. They're not installed yet. So projection land gets funny.
You've got some work to do.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
No, but I think it's a great idea. And again, solar panels are still relatively inexpensive. Their price still remains competitive, let's say.
Yeah, absolutely.
And did I hear you say that you want to evaluate American-made panels versus foreign-made panels or so? I mean, does that matter?
So I don't know the exact phrasing, but I think there's like a U.S.-built standard. And that's for test out. So the Chinese market was coming in and undercutting American panels, and they're having serious quality issues. We're not fixated on making sure that they're made in America so much as they hit the quality standards.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, we're talking with Matt Abbott. He's Environmental Program Manager at Park City Municipal Corporation. Let's take a break for a couple underwriters, and we come back. We got a couple other questions. We're a little update on what else is going on in the sustainability world and in the town. It's This Green Earth, and we'll be back right after this.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Join us for Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m. only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak, Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power Watt Smart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, wattsmart.com.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage service and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Help keep Summit County Recycling clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. She's Nell Larson. I'm Chris Cherniak. In the studio is Matt Abbott with Park City Municipal Corporation. We got a few more minutes. Let's talk about, you said there was one item you wanted to add with respect to solar.
Yeah. Park City is part of the American Solar Transformation Initiative. It's in a slew of acronyms. It's a DOE project. We're in with about 200 other cities, and the point of the project is to reduce the soft cost of solar. I love this project because we have a consultant that comes with it, and we're working with our building department, our planning department, and on market development for all sorts of solar. So it's really good to have the professionals with Optony, that's the consulting firm, working with our building department and planning department to simplify things, to bring down the cost of solar installations, and to help us to continue to improve the market.
So when you say the soft costs of solar, give us some of the examples that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's everything from permitting to installation. It's basically all the human factors outside of just buying a panel and having it appear on your roof. And those are the costs that keep the cost of solar high.
That's interesting. And it's also kind of that it just seems complicated. It's something new. It's something that we don't have a lot of experience with.
Absolutely. And the whole leverage point from Optony is they've worked with hundreds of other cities on these issues. So they can give us the playbook. They can be like, hey, building department, do you want to save 50 hours? You do this and we'll save you 50 hours a year. And so when they start to have to assess their costs and their staff time, they can charge less for a solar installation at the end of the 2-year process than where we're at now. So it's not sexy work by any means, but right. It's really good for long-term markets.
Right. Okay.
I don't know. This Green Earth listeners might think that's sexy. Depends on your audience.
We have a strange sense of what is and what isn't sexy and the environment. Yeah, exactly. So this is just something, like you say, a consultant is going to put together a report to present you some operational
yeah. So we're actually getting tracked and scored online on Solar Roadmap. If you Google search Solar Roadmap, we'll pop up. And that whole process is supposed to bring us up to a spot and keep us competitive with other communities so we continue to improve this market. And something that we're just starting to kind of kick around is municipal bulk solar. So everyone remembers Summit Community Solar, mm-hmm. and we're pursuing the same thing from a municipal scale. And so that's like 3 to 4 megawatts if we can pull something together, and it'd wrap in the county, it'd wrap in the school districts and whatever other government bodies that we could include for a really huge solar installation if it all comes together. But that's one of the services that comes with the grant, comes with Optony.
Okay. And like you mentioned, the school district is also considering solar, at least the first phase.
They are, and this would be a great second phase for them. If we could leverage bulk purchasing at that scale, they could get a better price for sure.
Oh, okay. Fantastic. Well, I think it's great ideas. Again, it's just a matter of making the numbers work
yeah.
and convincing the people that it's worth the payback. But I think we're seeing more and more of that. More and more people, private and public concerns, are installing solar systems. So there's value there. I mean, you have it at the, like you said, at the Swanner Eco Center. Do you have any sense of what kind of savings you get from your panels?
We do. So our panels create about 12 to 15% of our energy.
Really?
And we use about half of the energy of a comparable facility.
Right.
We've kind of checked those numbers with some other facilities around town, and we're doing pretty well on that. We still think there's room for improvement. But where I was going with that is that 12% is, you know, is a significant portion
it
of
is.
Our electricity, you know, it'd be close to a quarter of a conventional building. And, you know, I don't have the costs in front of me, but that's all stuff that we've actually started looking at this year and tracking our energy use and our natural gas use and our costs.
You have a lot of natural lighting, too, at your place.
We do. And actually, so some of the issues that we have tend to be opposite that of your average facility. So we don't have a lot of low-hanging fruit that we can get rid of. And they say usually with, you know, when you're doing these energy audits, electricity is one where you can really quickly tick some things off the list. But we hardly ever use lights. We have, you know, in our offices, I mean, it's probably 50-50 whether there's a single light on. And so, yeah, it's been an interesting process. Chris just turned off the light in the studio.
I'm the guy that runs around the mark turning off all the fans, too. I don't understand why you need fans. You're there to sweat. So I turn off all the fans. My little efforts there, but that's really impressive. Now, so it's worth looking into. And while the costs are competitive, the unit costs have come down for panels and installation, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely.
And they're busier. What is a little depressing is that when I went to the Governor's Energy Summit, and we'll get into some more of these facts in the second part of the show. Here's one thing though: is that solar in this state accounts for less than 1%. Of the energy that's generated in the state. It's really – I was shocked at that. But
Matt Abbott is going to single-handedly
City. In this town, it's much more than 1%. I don't know if you have a sense of what it is, but I'm
city,
sure.
The city's total portfolio is about 0.5% of our total use is generated through solar.
Really?
Yeah, and when you look statewide, we're at like 85-87% coal and then another 9% natural gas.
Yeah.
It's tough to beat that.
But so Matt, before we let you go, are there any other projects that you are working on at the city that you want to mention?
I'm really excited to keep working with the Georgetown University Energy Prize team. Mm-hmm. We're making progress, and I think we'll have something pretty exciting by this fall to start to push out to the community and be competitive with.
So for those who aren't familiar with the Georgetown University Energy Prize, what is that?
It is a $5 million X Prize to the community that reduces residential energy the most between 2015 and 2016. So we'll be launching programs. We'll be tracking residential energy use. We'll be getting after it. And hopefully
running around town, turning
That's
off.
Right.
People's lights. That's part of the plan.
I think our population here is like a pretty competitive group of people, so
Absolutely.
I think we have a good chance.
It's $5 million. Winner takes all.
Yeah.
High stakes.
And we're competing against?
Well, Aspen's in the mix. Salt Lake's in the mix. Bellevue, Washington. There's about 51 cities that I know of right now.
Right.
Good representation from California and Michigan.
There's our competition, our loyal opposition. So we'll learn more about that as we go forward.
Definitely.
So Matt Abbott, Environmental Project Manager at Park City Municipal Corporation, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Chatting about, among other things, plans for solar at the Mark. We'll stay on top of that. Let's take a break
for some
underwriters. And we've got a new segment.
That's right. We're coming back with a new program that we're excited to tell you about.
All right.
After the break.
That's
right.
It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort, supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for?
TED Radio Hour, Sunday morning at 10. Brought to you by Board Docs.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. Hey, we have a new segment we want to share with you. We're going to launch it in a minute. It's something called Wild About Utah now?
Yeah, it is. So this is a radio program locally made here in Utah, up in Logan, actually, and it's created by Utah Public Radio. And we started talking with them about some collaborations. And this program is like 2 to 4 minute segments, and focuses on the natural world. And the presenters kind of get to choose their own topic each week and put a piece together. And so you get really interesting focused pieces on a single item.
Okay.
And so we'll be sharing those with our listeners starting
right
today.
Now.
Yeah.
And we're not sure what this segment's about. We'll have to actually listen in. Ready?
That's right. Sounds good. Here we go.
Here we go. Wild About Utah.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Bridgerland Audubon Society, USU Extension, and the Quinney College of Natural Resources at Utah State University.
Immortalized on the sets of old Western movies, the tumbleweed has long been a classic symbol of the rugged, wide-open landscapes of the American West. As a result, we can all easily recognize the spherical skeletons when we come across them caught on underbrush or piled up on fence lines here in Utah. But this archetype is not an accurate representation of typical Western United States or Utah flora, because tumbleweed, or Russian thistle, is an invasive weed. The story begins in the late 19th century when South Dakotan farmers reported seeing an unknown plant growing in their croplands. Years later, it was identified as Russian thistle, scientific name Salsola tragus, a native plant of Russia and the Eurasian steppes east of the Ural Mountains. It had been accidentally brought to the United States in a shipment of flaxseed. By the time the U.S. Department of Agriculture published its inquiry into the plant in 1894, about 20 years after the plant's introduction, 35,000 square miles of land had become more or less covered in Russian thistle. Since that time, the plant has spread into every state except Florida and Alaska. So what is the problem? Russian thistle, despite the nostalgic connotations of the Old West it inspires, is a pest. It easily takes root in disturbed or bare ground, moving in before native species are able to establish. Drought conditions, like those we have had in recent years, only promote the plant's proliferation. The dryness hinders the growth of crops and native species, while the Salsola seed requires very little moisture in order to germinate, growing in where the crops and native species otherwise would have. This can have deleterious effects on cropland and natural ecological functioning, not to mention the wildfire risk the dry plant debris poses. Their sheer numbers have also turned into more than just a nuisance. Each plant may bear some 250,000 seeds that can be spread across miles as they drop off the rolling tumbleweed. Consequently, we see images like those from Colorado earlier this year, depicting piles of tumbleweeds filling streets, covering cars, and climbing the walls of houses. In one instance, a windstorm clogged a town in New Mexico with 435 tons of the weed. Utahns have yet to experience the full effects of this plant's troublesome nature, but this does not mean we are immune. Russian thistle has been reported in every county of the state. Luckily for those fighting this plant's advance, technology and research are on our side. Several biological control options, from insects to fungal pathogens, are being tested as methods of natural Salsola population suppression, with encouraging results. But all in all, the management principles have not changed much since 1894. Prevent the production and dispersal of seed across all infested areas. For Wild About Utah, I'm Anna Bengtson.
Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Bridgerland Audubon Society, USU Extension, and the Quinney College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah on UPR is made possible in part by our listeners and the Quinney College of Natural Resources, where students and faculty promote the sustainability of ecosystems and the communities that depend on them. Information at cnr.usu.edu.
Welcome back.
Yeah, nice. A little piece about Wild About Utah about tumbleweeds.
That's right.
I did not know. Okay, so now here's a couple of things I didn't know. Okay. I didn't know they were Russian thistle. I thought tumbleweeds could be
I thought it was like a generic term. And there's actually, there's a plant here that's kind of weedy. Like, it's not a noxious weed, but it'll grow in disturbed areas. It's pretty widespread. And it's called, like, the common name is tumble mustard. Mm. And I thought maybe that's where the name tumbleweed came from. But
so
it's Russian thistle.
Is Russian thistle on the Swanner?
We don't have Russian thistle on the Swanner Preserve. But according to Anna, yeah, it's you know, located in other places in Summit County. And it sounds like it was originally spread in agricultural seed. So maybe that's one that's more of an issue in the eastern part of the county that we're not struggling with here yet, as you said.
Right, yeah. I mean, everywhere but Florida or Alaska is pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
So it sounds like they must spread their seeds through the act of rolling, or at least seeds get spread. I wonder if that's how they actually plan that.
I know. Good question. Maybe we can get Anna Bankston on the air to talk about it. But I wanted to mention that Anna actually is a Park City local, so it was fun to start out with her today. And she's creating these programs as a partnership with Utah State University Extension and Swanner.
Great.
So, yeah, we're really happy to have her involved.
And we're happy to have Wild About Utah on the show. We'll have those hopefully every week a little bit about ecosystems and environmental issues and for Utah. So thanks for that. Let's take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll get into our news items, honeybees and energy summits and increasing temperatures in the U.S. And we'll introduce our intern EJ Elliott. Part of our news team. It's this
on-air debut.
Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, formerly Prudential, Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and this green earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers watt-smart advice such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. because it helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Mel Larson. That's Chris Cherniak across the board. And we want to welcome EJ Elliott to the show.
Why?
Thank you for coming on the air today.
Our summer intern.
Yeah, summer intern.
That's
EJ,
right.
you're attending
University of
Virginia. And what are you studying?
Right now, I'm undecided, but I'm probably transferring to the architecture school and focusing on urban planning, architecture, and global sustainability.
EJ just finished her freshman year. Is that right?
First year at the University of Virginia.
First year.
We have different terminology for everything.
Okay. All right. So first year at the University of Virginia. So, you know, we can't pin her down on a major yet, but environmental science would be recommended.
Well, your dad's an architect.
Yeah. My father's an architect.
And you're helping him out.
Yes.
Building things this summer.
Yeah.
Designing.
Fun things.
Okay. Well, EJ is, like I say, interning and helping us collect news items during the summer, and we're going to get into some of our news stories this week. And now, do you want to kick things off with some stories related to honeybees?
Yeah, absolutely. So these are actually both kind of pretty fun, interesting stories. A couple weeks ago, we had a beekeeper on the show, and we talked about some of the risks to honeybees and some of the problems with their populations right now. And so one of the interesting pieces of news is that there is something called a biopesticide that's being developed right now. And so it's a pesticide, and it's based on spider venom. Mm. And it attacks the central nervous system of agricultural pests like aphids, caterpillars, things like that.
Okay.
Common pests, and doesn't harm honeybees. And so an independent study looked at this. Mm. And so here's the way it works. This is – you hang in with me for 1 minute. Okay. So proteins from the spider venom – are combined with a carrier protein that transports that neurotoxin across the insect's gut wall so that they can absorb it. And then that disrupts the calcium channels that allow ions into nerve cells.
Sure.
Killing the bugs.
Got it.
So, but that doesn't happen to the bees, and they think it's because it has different calcium channels, and so it doesn't disrupt their nervous system in the same way.
Good.
So the good news here is that, you know, this might be a slightly more targeted pesticide and leave the honeybees alone to pollinate the crops, which is also really important.
Right. Okay. So very encouraging there.
Yeah, very encouraging news.
Okay.
So the team that did this study also conducted like memory and learning tests with the bees by putting out, you know, like sugary solutions.
Oh.
And so the bees, when impacted by this pesticide or when they'd had like various doses of the pesticide, still had high levels of like learning and memory. So if they learned what a certain flower looked like,
sure,
they would know that that was a good food source and they would remember where it was and they could get back to it. And those are some of the problems that other pesticides were causing. Like the bees didn't know where they were going.
Right.
They
get
effective.
Confused. That's right. Some of the neonicotinoids had that capability to confuse them and disorient them.
Right, exactly. Like they wouldn't even be able to find their way back to their hive, things like that. But in this, with this study, they found that they were with this new pesticide. So it'll be interesting to see when this comes on the market and if it's
spider
used
venom
in a masked way. Yeah. It's not actually spider venom, but it's, you know, mimicked spider venom.
Oh,
so it's
synthetic.
Yeah.
Form
yeah,
of spider.
That's my
venom
understanding. They're not actually
that would be
harvesting
spider. All right. Yeah. We get it.
Be an arduous process,
yes,
I think.
Yes. Okay.
So also on the bee front, a new study shows that blueberries are impacted by the number of species of bees that they're pollinated by more so than actually the number of bees that come through the plant. And so to study this, this team observed individual blueberry plants and observed the species of bees that were pollinating individual flowers. So, I mean, they sat there for like an extremely long length of time, a pollination season.
Grad students.
Okay. And counted and tabulated these things. And then on other plants, they covered them with a really fine like screen mesh, just the flowering parts and not the whole plant, so they couldn't be pollinated by anything other than what they put in there. And so they put in honeybees and then they put in one wild specialty pollinator. And they found that the plants that had various species of bees from five different families were did much better. They grew more fruit. The fruit had more seeds. It was larger. It had all kinds of impacts on the actual fruit harvest. So they crunched some numbers for North Carolina. They said for each additional species present during bloom, fruits produced an average of 3.66 more viable seeds. This translates to $757 more per hectare, which is $1.4 million for all high bush blueberry grown in North Carolina each
year.
Wow. So economic impacts as well.
Sure.
But it speaks to the need to maybe like diversify the pollinators that we're using and conserve and protect these native, you know, pollinators that we are counting on.
How many times do we have discussions that involve diversity, the importance of diversity?
Right.
And here's the consequences of it.
Yeah.
A healthier blueberry.
That's right. And the native bees did much better during like bad weather. So when it was pouring rain, if it was really windy, if it was really cold, the honeybees, the European honeybees that we used as our main pollinators, kind of like stopped working, went back to the hive, took cover.
Close up for the day.
Yeah. And with these wild bees, they found that, let's see, wild bumblebees, carpenter bees, and small native bees carried on rain or shine.
Huh.
And so when you have different bees coming at different times and with different conditions, that stabilizes the amount of pollination happening. So just lots of different benefits.
And if it's going on for blueberries, then what are the chances that maybe this is happening for strawberries and raspberries and other fruits in general?
Yeah.
So diversity.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great.
It's nice to hear it quantified, right? Because I think we're always saying diversity is important.
Right.
And these things make a difference. But then you see the numbers and you think, okay, we can talk about this quantitatively.
So just one – all I would need maybe is just – one blueberry instead of 8 or 9 in my cereal.
Well, I don't know
one
about
giant
that.
Sliced. Okay. But we get the idea.
Yeah.
All right. That's a great story. EJ, you're up. What story do you have?
So my story is about the temperature records are showing that certain corners of the United States are actually increasing temperature more than the other ones.
Okay.
So an analysis of federal temperature records show that the United States is warming fastest in the northeast corner and the southwest corner. So states like Maine and Vermont, which are the leaders in the northeastern states, mm-hmm. are gaining 2.5 degrees on average. And this is based off of 1984 records.
So about 30 years of
30
records.
Years, yeah.
Over the past 30 years. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then states like New Mexico and Texas, leading the southwestern states, are gaining 3.4 and 2.8 degrees respectively. So,
okay.
You know, the dog days.
3.4?
Yeah. So the dog days in Texas are, you know, pretty bad now.
Right. They're yeah. getting warmer. And you said this is information from the National Climatic Data Center.
Yeah, that's correct.
That collects this data. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting. Over the last 30 years, mm-hmm. the northeast part of the U.S. is getting warmer mm-hmm. by, say, so somewhere around 2.5 degrees, and the southwest part is also getting warmer. Not yeah. to say that other parts of the country may be experiencing warmer temperatures. In fact,
yeah. It's back everywhere else besides North Dakota. Just North Dakota. That's the one thing that's getting cooler. Everywhere else is getting rising temperatures.
It's experiencing mm-hmm. warmer temperatures.
Yeah.
Of one, I'll say it, degree or another.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're trying to come up with reasons of why, but the best reason is there's different atmosphere, like, areas that, like, are in the country and, you know, just the weather is different in different
right.
areas. But basically what they say in the article is that it's just random. There's nothing really pinning it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. They're not suggesting that overall this is the warming trend is due to increasing greenhouse gases?
The warming trend is definitely due to greenhouse gases.
Okay.
But the differences in what areas are getting hit is just...
Why?
Yeah.
Pinpointing those spots.
And that area and not yeah. the northwest or the southeast.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, those maple syrup producers in the northeast are not going to be happy
no,
to hear that.
Because that impacts their...
It does, yeah. If it gets too warm, they don't
too
get...
Too warm. Mm-hmm. It throws everything out of cycle.
That's right. And the sugar maples need the cold temps.
They do.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, all right. That's good stuff. Thanks, EJ.
That is good stuff.
Well, while we're at it on temperatures, what's the next story? This is really interesting about relating heat in urban settings and air conditioning systems?
Yes. So according to scientists at Arizona State University, they have found that air conditioning systems are now actually causing a difference in temperatures. So they're actually increasing temperatures at night, not the daytime. The daytime, it hasn't been quite as noticeable.
Right.
But at night, there's at least like 1 to 2 degrees difference in urban areas that have a lot of air conditioning. So, of course, places like Phoenix are going to be experiences.
Right.
Places in the southwest that use a lot of air conditioning in the summer.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What a horrible feedback loop. Like, you're cooling because it's hot, and then you're making the outdoors hotter, so you need the cooling more.
Yeah.
And I think in the past, like, I always thought of it as a little bit of a cycle because you're using energy, you're releasing carbon into the atmosphere, making the whole world warmer. But on such a local basis, that's...
Right, you're increasing the, scary. In this case, the heat island effect
mm-hmm.
by running, which is probably hundreds of thousands of air conditioners.
Yeah, you can just imagine downtown Phoenix.
So perhaps there's a way they can capture this heat.
Yeah.
And do something good with it.
Yeah, the lead author of this study
was
actually urging people to consider sustainable development and optimization of electricity consumption. So basically what he's saying is turning that wasted heat that's coming from the air conditioning systems and using that sort of energy for something else, that maybe you can use it for water heaters, for example.
Right.
Trying to just use that excess waste heat
yes.
and use it for something that's productive
instead
of just putting it out there.
Preheat water or so
yeah.
in the systems.
Instead of directly counterproductive.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. That's great. Good stories, EJ. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, EJ.
Well, while we're on a roll here, I'll try to throw in my two cents. I attended
it's your turn now, Chris.
Right,
you're on the spot.
You I attended the 3rd Annual Governor's Energy Development Summit last week. And here's just some general takeaways. From
give us the highlights.
Highlight, Governor Herbert spoke at lunch. And here's basically he said, this is a quote, "Utah is open for business." Got a drill rig. Got a drill rig. Come on in. That's basically the word there. The summit itself had a lot of presentations, breakout sessions, and of course, booths and other vendors were there. And of course, it was big reliance on a big presence by the oil and gas industry. Okay, but not so much on coal. Coal was not necessarily invited or did a lot of speaking. The coal industry, heavy on oil and gas. Conversely, quite a bit on solar when it came to renewables, not much on wind. So more emphasis, it seemed, on the conversations about how to develop more solar energy in a state like we were talking with Matt. Less than 1% of this state's energy comes from solar power. So there's a lot of opportunity there, and at least they were touching on that.
So how many people attended this?
I would say it was probably a little less than 1,000.
Okay.
Somewhere around there. It was, let's say the lunch area, it was full. So yeah. I think they were practically at their capacity, expected capacity. Most of it is going to be representatives of industry and municipalities, et cetera. That's what I saw from the badges walking around. So here's another couple other takeaways. Renewable sources, like I said, account for 1.8% of the state's energy production. That's solar, wind, geothermal, et cetera. So less than 2%. Here's something that's really interesting. Oil and gas industry accounts for less than 1% for the state's gross product. So we have this image that, this state is going to survive and depend upon oil and gas as part of its economy.
Yeah.
No, less than 1% of the state's gross product. And this is from their own documents. This isn't from some environmental group.
Some crazy lefty.
This is from their own state written documents, less than 2%. Of course, on the other hand, the conventional sources, natural gas is the big source of energy in the state, electricity. Energy, going along those lines, energy-related jobs in the state, about 1.4% of the total state employment.
So, and that's any energy-related jobs. So that's
gas, oil, coal,
renewables. Does that include renewables?
No, that was fossil fuels.
Okay.
So oil's less than 2% of this state is employed. Employees are involved in the fossil fuel industry. Not much.
Now,
if you go to Duchesne or Carbon or Uinta County, then it's probably 85% of people.
Right.
But the point is, this is, you know, we have an economy here that is more agricultural based, more research based. Educational based, municipal based, et cetera.
Tourism recreation
based, et cetera.
Yeah.
Just a couple other things. Okay.
Question though. So what is the purpose or the goal of this? You know, this summit, this meeting, is the governor or his committee looking for input? Is it to come up with new ideas? Is it just to network?
Ideas, networking, and inviting additional opportunities from those who want to come into the state and expand oil and natural gas development. Oil shale or kerogen shale is still out there, is always in play.
That just makes me cringe.
Well, the one that is really concerning is the oil sands. That is something that is a lot closer to full-scale development than you can imagine. But I want to run as far as recoverable oil in the state. I had a number here. In 2013, there were 35 million barrels of oil produced in this state. Okay? Sounds like a lot. 35 million barrels of oil. This country consumes roughly 19 million barrels of oil. Anybody?
Per day.
So that's 2 days worth of inventory. So what this state produced last year.
Not even 2 days of inventory.
Barely 2 days worth of inventory. So it puts it in perspective. Again, we're like 11th or 12th as far as in the order of states as far as oil production in this country. So we don't produce a lot. But oil sands, there's some 600 million barrels of oil estimated in the oil sands. But again, that sounds like a lot, but it's about 30 days worth of inventory.
Right. You think of the massive impact that that would have on our state's recreational opportunities and environment and wildlife. So and then it's like a month.
So the guy, again, your point taken now that the goal for this was to kind of highlight what's going on in this state and the fact that they're open for business with respect to fossil fuel extraction, but there's a lot of potential environmental impacts and not so much in the economic or job related impacts when you put it in perspective for what you actually generate.
In the full picture.
Yeah. So anyway, that's all of that is available online. You can go just do a search on the third annual Governor's Energy Development Summit or one of those terms, and you can get all the talks online, the presentations too. So
did you get in there and express your views on developing renewables and solar?
Or? No. I just took a lot of notes and grabbed a lot of material and went home and read about it and decided to share it with you.
The development of oil.
All right, let's take one more break. We got to wrap up. We've got a calendar event and what's coming up on...
That's right, on the Mountain Lives tomorrow morning.
We'll cover that right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage service provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more each year in their residential curbside recycling bin. Please help by putting acceptable recyclables in and keeping glass out. Thank you, Summit County. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up. We got a couple of calendar events and what's going on in the mountain life. What do you got?
Well, I wanted to mention an event that's happening tonight. There's a new Park City-specific birding group or Summit County-specific birding group kind of forming. Hmm. There's a Great Salt Lake Audubon. We don't have a local chapter here. And that group is meeting at 7 p.m. tonight at the Swanner Eco Center. I work at the Eco Center, and we're kind of partnering with them to see if we can help get them off the ground. And so at 7 p.m. tonight, they have a presenter coming, Kathy Donnell from Wasatch State Park, and she'll be bringing actually a few of her raptors to talk about and to talk about local bird populations.
Really?
Yeah. And, they're kind of going to be talking about a name and preferences and what people are interested in. So I wanted to throw that out there.
Sure.
It's a great time of year for birding.
Good.
So there's an event for tonight if you're interested.
Well, while you're there, I'm probably going to be over at the open house that Tesoro is holding at the South Summit Middle School. That's in Camas. And they're going to be talking about the Uinta Express Pipeline. So open house there. It's at 6 p.m. at the South Summit Middle School. That's 355 East, 300 South in downtown Camas. So I'll be attending that, and I'll give a report on that next week.
That's right. Report back. Your homework.
Exactly. So what's on the Mountain Life?
That's
tomorrow?
Right. Tomorrow on the Mountain Life, Tim and Lynn will speak with Kathy Beals, nutrition professor at the U of U and nationally ranked master's triathlete, about raising the bar in performance. And then in the second half, Michael Russer, he is a cancer survivor who was rendered impotent when his prostate was removed. We'll talk about the sensitive subject and some of the surprising, quote, upsides of his condition. Lynn wrote that this was specially written for me to read on air.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
You know, they're good at covering those touchy subjects.
Yeah.
That's right.
Her and Tim can handle that much better.
That's right.
Than
we can.
Well, it's time to wrap up. Another great show. Thanks to Matt Abbott talking about Mark Solar. Let's thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Republic Services, Habitat for Humanity's Restore, Vail Resorts, Rocky Mountain Power, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Utah Real Estate.
You can also join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth and give us a like.
And also email us your thoughts at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. org. Thanks again, EJ Elliott, our newest member,
crack research member, team.
Research team. Thanks for joining us. She'll be a regular for the rest of the summer. And remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.